Poems, Rainer Maria Rilke. Listen to and download free AI-generated audiobooks at 3ords.com. The Project Gutenberg eBook of Poems. This eBook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this eBook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this eBook. Title: Poems, Author: Rainer Maria Rilke, Translator: Jesse Lemont. Release date: January 17, 2012. eBook 38594. Most recently updated: October 4, 2016. Language: English. Other information and formats: www.gutenberg.org/ebook/38594. Credits: produced by Andrea Ball and Mark DeHook. Images generously made available by the Internet Archive asterisk. Start of the project: GUTENBRGEBOOKPOEMS asterisk. Poems by Rainer Maria Rilke, translated by Jesse Lamont, with an introduction by H.T. New York, Tobias A. Wright, 1918, to the memory O.F. August R.O.D.I.N., through whom I came to know Rainer Maria Rilke. Contents: introduction, the poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke, first poems. Evening, Mary Virgin, the book of pictures, presaging autumn, silent hour, the angels, solitude, kings in legends, the night, the boy, initiation, the neighbor, song of the statue, maiden's eye, I, the bride, autumnal day, moonlight night, in April, memories of a childhood, death, the shanti, remembrance, music, maiden melancholy, maidens at confirmation, the woman who loves, Pont du Carousel, madness, lament, symbols, new poems, early Apollo, the tomb of a young girl, the poet, the panther, growing blind, the Spanish dancer, offering, love song, archaic torso of Apollo, the book of hours, the book of a monk's life. I live my life in circles, many have painted her, in cassocks clad, thou anxious one. I love my life's dark hours, the book of pilgrimage. By day thou art the legend and the dream, all those who seek thee. In a house was one, extinguish my eyes, in the deep nights. The book of poverty and death, her mouth. Alone thou wanderest, a watcher of thy spaces. Poems of Rainer Maria Rilke. Introduction, acknowledgement to the editors of Poetry, a magazine of verse and poet lore. The translator is indebted for permission to reprint certain poems in this book, also to the compilers of the following anthologies: Amphora II, edited by Thomas Bird Mosher, The Catholic Anthology of World Poetry, selected by Carl Van Doren. Title page: Dugald Stewart Walker. The Poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke. Epsilon letter 1 F 36, Sigma letter 1 F 76, Gamma letter 1 F 70, Rho Omicron letter 1 F 56, Nu Omicron letter 1 F 33, letter 1 F 10, Nu Tau Alpha letter 1 F D 6, Sigma Psi Upsilon Chi Alpha letter 1 F D 6, Sigma Kappa Upsilon Omicron letter 1 F E 6, Sigma Yoda Nu Plato. The supreme problem of every age is that of finding its consummate artistic expression. Before this problem, every other remains of secondary importance. History defines and directs its physical course. Science cooperates in the achievement of its material aims, but art alone gives to the age its spiritual physiognomy, its ultimate and lasting expression. The process of art is on the one hand sensuous, the conception having, for its basis, the fineness of organization of the senses, and on the other hand it is severely scientific, the value of the creation being dependent upon the craftsmanship, the mastery over the tool, the technique. Art, like nature, its great and only reservoir for all time past and all time to come, ever strives for elimination and selection. It is severe and aristocratic in the application of its laws and impervious to appeal, to serve other than its own aims. Its purpose is the symbolization of life. In its sanctum, there reigns the silence of vast accomplishment, the serene, final, and imperturbable solitude, which is the ultimate criterion of all great things created. To speak of poetry is to speak of the most subtle, the most delicate, and the most accurate instrument by which to measure life. Poetry is reality's essence visioned and made manifest by one endowed with a perception acutely sensitive to sound, form, and color, and gifted with a power to shape into rhythmic and rhymed verbal symbols the reaction to life's phenomena. The poet molds that which appears evanescent and ephemeral in image and in mood into everlasting values. In this act of creation, he serves eternity. Poetry, in especial lyrical poetry, must be acknowledged the supreme art, culminating as it does in a union of the other arts, the musical, the plastic, and the pictorial. The most eminent contemporary poets of Europe have, each in accordance, with his individual temperament, reflected in their work the spiritual essence of our age, its fears and failures, its hopes and high achievements. Maeterlinck, with his mood of resignation and his retirement into a dusky twilight where his shadowy figures move, noiselessly like phantoms in fate-laden dimness. Daimel, the worshipper of will, with his passion for materiality and the beauty of all things, physical and tangible. Verheeren, the visionary of a new vitality, who sees in the toilers of fields and factories the heroic gesture of our time, and who might have written its great epic of industry, but for the overwhelming lyrical mood of his soul. Until a few years ago, known only to a relatively small community on the continent, but commanding an ever-increasing attention which has borne his name far beyond the boundary of his country, the personality of Rainer Maria Rilke stands today beside the most illustrious poets of modern Europe. The background against which the figure of Rainer Maria Rilke is silhouetted is so varied, the influences which have entered into his life are so manifold, that a study of his work, however slight, must needs take into consideration the elements through which this poet has matured into a great master. Prague, the city in which Rilke was born in 1875, with its sinister palaces and crumbling towers that rose in the early Middle Ages and have reached out into our time like the threatening fingers of mighty hands, which have wielded swords for generations and which are stained with the blood of many wounds of many races. The city where, amid gray old ruins, blonde maidens are at play or are lost in reverie in the green cool parks and shady gardens with which the Bohemian capital abounds, this Prague of mingled grotesqueness and beauty gave to the young boy his first impressions. There is a period in the life of every artist when his whole being seems lost in a contemplation of the surrounding world, when the application to work is difficult, like the violent forcing of something that is awaiting its time. This is the time of his dream, as sacred as the days of early spring before wind and rain and light have touched the fruits of the fields, when there is a tense, bleak silence over the whole of nature, in which is wrapped the strength of storms and the glow of the summer sun. This is the time of his deepest dream, and upon this dream and its guarding depends the final realization of his life's work. The young graduate of the gymnasium was to enter upon the career of an army officer in accordance with the traditions of the family, an old, noble house which traces its lineage far back to Corinthian ancestry. His inclinations, however, pointed so decisively in the direction of the finer arts of life that he left the military academy after a very short attendance to devote himself to the study of philosophy and the history of art. As one turns the pages of Rilke's first small book of poems, published originally under the title Lehrenopfer, in the year 1895, and which appeared in more recent editions under the less descriptive name Erst Gedicht, one realizes at once, in spite of a lack of plasticity in the presentation, that here speaks one who has lingered long and lovingly over the dream of his boyhood. As the title indicates, these poems are a tribute and offering to the Lares, the home spirits of his native town. Prague and the surrounding country are the ever-recurring theme of almost every one of these poems. The meadows, the maidens, the dark river in the evening, the spires of the cathedral at night rising like gray mists are seen with a wonderment, the great wellspring of all poetic imagination with a well-nigh religious piety. Through all these poems there sounds like a subdued accompaniment, a note of gratitude for the ability to thus vision the world, to be sunk in the music of all things. Without is everything that I feel within myself, and without, and within myself everything is immeasurable, illimitable. These pictures of town and landscape are never separated from their personal relation to the poet. He feels too keenly his dependence upon them, as a child views flowers and stars as personal possessions. Not until later was he to reach the height of an impersonal objectivity in his art. What distinguishes these early poems from similar adolescent productions is the restraint in the presentation, the economy and intensity of expression, and that quality of listening to the inner voice of things which renders the poet the seer of mankind. The second book of poems appeared 2 years later, and like the first volume, Traumgekrönt, is full of the music that is reminiscent of the mild melancholy of the Bohemian folk songs, in whose gentle rhythms the barbaric strength of the race seems to be lulled to rest as the waves of A faraway tumultuous sea gently lapped the shore. The themes of Tromgekrønt are extended somewhat beyond the immediate environment of Prague, and some of the most beautiful poems are luminous pictures of villages hidden in the snowy blossoming of May and June, out of which rises here and there the solitary soft voice of a boy or girl singing. In these first two volumes, the poet is satisfied with painting in words, full of sonorous beauty, the surrounding world. From this period dates the small poem Evening, which seems to have been sketched by a Japanese painter, so clear and colorful is its texture, so precious and precise are its outlines, with Advent and Mirzer Fire, both published within the following 3 years. A phase of questioning commences, a dim desire begins to stir to reach out into the larger world, deep into life, out beyond time. Whereas the early poems were characterized by a tendency to turn away from the turmoil of life, in fact, the concrete world of reality does not seem to exist. There is noticeable in these two later volumes an advance toward life in the sense that the poet is beginning to approach and to vision some of its greatest symbols. Throughout the entire work of Rilke, in his poetry as well as in his interpretations of painting and sculpture, there are two elements that constitute the cornerstones in the structure of his art. If, as has been said with a degree of verity, Nietzsche was primarily a musician whose philosophy had for its basis and took its ultimate aspects from the musical quality of his artistic endowment, it may be maintained with an equal amount of truth that Rilke is primarily a painter and sculptor, whose poetry rests upon the fundaments of the pictorial and plastic arts. Up to the time of the publication of these volumes, Rilke's poems possessed a quietude, a stillness suggested in the straight, unbroken yet delicate lines of the picture which he portrays and in the soft, almost unpulsating rhythm of his words. The approach of evening or nightfall, the coming of dawn, the change of the seasons, the slow changes of light into darkness and of darkness into light, in short, the most silent yet greatest metamorphoses in the external aspects of nature form the contents of many of these first poems. The inanimate object and the living creature in nature are not seen in the sharp contours of their isolation. They are viewed and interpreted in the atmosphere that surrounds them, in which they are enwrapped and so densely veiled that the outlines are only dimly visible, be that atmosphere the mystic gray of northern twilight or the dark velvety blue of southern summer nights. In Advent, the experience of the atmosphere becomes an experience in his innermost soul, and therefore all things become of value to him only insofar as they partake of the atmosphere as they are seen in a peculiar air and distance. This first phase in Rilke's work may be defined as the phase of reposeful nature, to this sphere of relaxation and restfulness in which the objects are static and are changed only as the surrounding atmosphere affects them. The second phase in the poet's development adds another element, which later was to grow into dimensions so powerful, so violently breaking, beyond the limitations of simple expression in words that it could only find its satisfaction in a dithyrambic hymn to the work of the great plastic artist of our time, to the creations of Auguste Rodin. This second element is that which the French sculptor in a different medium has carried to perfection. It is the element of gesture, of dramatic movement. This might seem the appropriate place in which to speak of Rilke's monograph on the art of Rodin. To do so would, however, be an undue anticipation, for it will be necessary to trace Rilke's development through several transitions before the value of his contact with the work of Rodin can be fully measured. The gesture, the movement begins in Advent and Celebration to disturb the stillness prevailing in the first two volumes of poems. Even here it is only gentle and shy at first, like the stirring of a breath of wind over a quiet sea, and gentle beings make this first gesture. Children and young women at play, singing, dancing, or at prayer. Particularly in the cycle Songs of the Maidens, in the book Celebration, the atmosphere is condensed and becomes the psychic background of the landscape against which the gesture of longing or expectation is seen and felt. It is the impatience to burst into blossoming, the longing for love which pulsates in these Songs of the Maidens with the tenseness of suspense. The prayers of the maidens to Mary have not the mild melody of maidenly prayer. They vibrate with the ecstasy of expectant life, and the Madonna is more than the heavenly Virgin. Their longing transforms her into the symbol of earthly love and motherhood. This expectation, in spite of its intensity, is subdued and is only heard like the cadence of a far-off dream. How shall I go on tiptoe from childhood to annunciation, through the dim twilight, into thy garden? Mention should be made of some prose writings which Rilke published in the year 1898 and shortly afterward. They are Two Stories of Prague, The Touch of Life, and The Last, three volumes of short stories. A two-act drama, The Daily Life, points to a strong meter link, influence, and finally, Stories of God. With both beauty of detail and problematic interest, the short stories show an incoherence of treatment and a lack of dramatic coordination easily conceivable in a poet who is essentially lyrical and who at that time had not mastered the means of technique to give to his characters the clear chiseling of the epic. Form, A Sojourn in Russia, and especially the acquaintance with the novels of Dostoevsky became potent factors in Rilke's development and served to deepen creations which without this influence might have terminated in a grandiose aesthesia. Broadly speaking, Russian art and literature may be described as springing from an ethical impulse and as having for their motive power and raison d'etre, the tendency towards sociopolitical reform, in contradistinction to the art and literature of Western culture whose motives and aims are primarily of an aesthetic nature and seek in art the reconciliation of the dualism between spirit and matter. Dostoevsky, whom Merejkovsky describes somewhere as the man with the never young face, the face with its shadows of suffering and its wrinkles of sunken in cheeks. But that which gives to this face its most tortured expression is its seeming immobility, the suddenly interrupted impulse, the life hardened into a stone. This Dostoevsky, and particularly his Rodian Raskolnikov cycle became a profound, artistic experience to Rilke. The poor, the outcasts, the homeless ones, received for him a new significance, the significance of the isolated, figure placed in the mighty ever-changing current of a life in which this figure stands strong and solitary. In the poem entitled Pont du Carousel, written in Paris a few years later, Rilke has visioned the blind beggar aloof amid the fluctuating crowds of the metropolis. Of Russia and its influence upon him, Rilke writes, Russia became for me the reality and the deep daily realization that reality is something that comes infinitely slowly to those who have patience. Russia is the country where men are solitary, each one with a world within himself, each one profound in his humbleness and without fear of humiliating himself, and because of that truly pious. Here the words of men are only fragile bridges above their real life. The great symbols of solitude and of death enter into the poet's work. In the first decade of the new century, Rilke reached the height of his art, and with a few exceptions, the poems represented in this volume are selected from the poems which were published between the years 1900 and 1908. The ascent toward the acme of Rilke's art after the year 1900 is as rapid as it is precipitous. Only a few years previous, we read in Advent, that is longing, to dwell in the flux of things, to have no home in the present, and these are wishes, gentle dialogues of the poor hours with eternity. With Das Buch der Bilder, the dream is ended, the veil of mist is lifted, and before us are revealed pictures and images that rise before our eyes in clear, colorful contours. Whether the poet conjures from the depths of myth, the kings and legends, or whether we read from the Chronicle of a Monk, the awe-inspiring description of the Last Judgment Day, or whether in Paris on a Palm Sunday we see the maidens at confirmation, the pictures presented stand out with the clearness and finality of the typical. It is a significant fact that Rilke dedicated this book to Gerhard Hauptmann in love and gratitude for his Michael Kramer. Hauptmann, like Rilke in these poems, has placed before us great epic figures, and his art is so concentrated that often the simple expression of the thought of one of his characters produces a shudder in the listener or reader, because in this thought there vibrates the suffering of an entire social class, and in it resounds the sorrow of many generations. In The Book of Pictures, Rilke's art reaches its culmination on what might be termed its monumental side. The visualization is elevated to the impersonal objective level, which gives to the rhythm of these poems an imperturbable calm, to the figures presented a monumental erectness, the men of the House of Kalina, the Tsars, Charles XII riding through the Ukraine, are portrayed each with his individual historical gesture with a luminosity as strong as the color and movement which they gave to their time. In the mythical poem, Kings and Legends, this concrete element in the art of Rilke has found perhaps its supreme expression. Kings in old legends seem like mountains rising in the evening light. They blind all with their gleam. Their loins encircled are by girdles bright. Their robes are edged with bands of precious stones. The rarest earth affords with richly jeweled hands. They hold their slender, shining, naked swords. There are in The Book of Pictures poems in which this will to concentrate a mood into its essence and finality is applied to purely lyrical poems, as in Initiation. That stands out in this volume like the great dark tree itself. So immeasurable is the straight line of its aspiration reaching into the far distant silence of the night, or as in the poem entitled Autumn, with its melancholy mood of gentle descent in all nature, in The Book of Hours. Rilke withdraws from the world not from weariness, but weighed down under the manifold conflicting visions. As the prophet who would bring to the world a great possession must go forth into the desert to be alone until the kingdom comes to him from within, so the poet must leave the world in order to gain the deeper understanding to be face to face with God. The mood of Das, Stundenbuch, is this mood of being face to face with God. It elevates these poems to prayer, profound prayer of doubt and despair, exalted prayer of reconciliation and triumph. The Book of Hours contains three parts written at different periods in the poet's life: the Book of a Monk's Life, 1899, the Book of Pilgrimage, 1901, and the Book of Poverty and Death, 1903, although the entire volume was not published until several years later. The Book of Hours glows with a mystic fervor to know God, to be near him. In this desire to approach the Nameless One, the young brother in The Book of a Monk's Life builds up about God parables, images, and legends, reminiscent of those of the 17th century Angelus Celsius, but sustained by a more pregnant language because exalted by a more ardent visionary force. The motif of The Monk's Life is expressed in the poem beginning with the lines, I live my life in circles that grow wide and endlessly unroll. Through the gray cell of the young monk there flash in luminous magnificence the colors of the great Renaissance masters, for he feels in Titian, in Michelangelo, in Raphael the same fervor that animates him. They too are worshippers of the same God. There are poems in The Book of Pilgrimage of the stillness of a whispered prayer in a great cathedral, and there are others that carry in their exaltation the music of mighty hymns. The visions in this second book are no less ecstatic, though less glowingly colorful. They have withdrawn inward and have brought a great peace and a great faith, as in the poem of God, whose very manifestation is the quietude and hush of a silent world. By day thou art the legend and the dream that like a whisper floats about all men, the deep and brooding stillnesses which seem, after the hour has struck, to close again, and when the day with drowsy gesture bends and sinks to sleep beneath the evening skies, as from each roof a tower of smoke ascends, so does thy realm, my God, around me rise. The last part of The Book of Hours, The Book of Poverty and Death, is finally a symphony of variations on the two great symbolic themes in the work of Rilke. As Christ in the parable of the rich young man demands the abandonment of all treasures, so in this book the poet sees the coming of the kingdom, the fulfillment of all our longings for a nearness to God when we have become simple again like little children, and poor in possessions like God himself. In this phase of Rilke's development, the principle of renunciation constitutes a certain negative element in his philosophy. The poet later proceeded to a positive acquiescence toward man's possessions, at least those acquired or created in the domain of art. In our approach through the mystic, we touch reality most deeply. It is because of this that all art and all philosophy culminate in their final forms in a crystallization of those values of life that remain forever. Inexplicable to pure reason, they become religious in the simple, profound sense of that word. Before the eternal facts of life, doubt and strife are reconciled into faith, will and pride change into humility. The realization of this truth expressed in the medium of poetry is the significance of Rilke's Book of Hours. A distinguished Scandinavian writer has pronounced Das Stundenbuch one of the supreme literary achievements of our time and its deepest and most beautiful book of prayer. In his subsequent poetic work, Rilke did not again reach the sustained high quality of this book, the mood and idea of which he incorporated into a prose work of exquisite lyrical beauty, The Sketch of Malt, Lauridsbrig, in New Poems, 1907, and New Poems, Second Part, 1908. The historical figure frequently taken from the Old Testament has grown beyond the proportions of life. It is weightier with fate and invariably becomes the means of expressing symbolically an abstract thought or a great human destiny. Abishag presents the contrast between the dawning and the fading life. David singing before Saul shows the impatience of awakening ambition, and Joshua is the man who forces even God to do his will. The antique Hellenic world rises with shining splendor in the poems Irana to Sappho, Lament for Antinous, early Apollo and the archaic torso of Apollo. The spirit of the Middle Ages with its religious fervor and superstitious fanaticism is symbolized in several poems, the most important among which are The Cathedral, God in the Middle Ages, Saint Sebastian, personifying martyrdom, and The Rose Window, whose glowing magic is compared to the hypnotic power of the tiger's eye. Modern Paris is often the background of the new poems, and the crass play of light and shadow upon the waxen masks of life's disillusioned inn. The morgue is caught with the same intense realistic vision as the flamingos and parrots spreading their vari-colored soft plumage in the warmth of the sun in the avenue of the Jardin des Plantes. Almost all of the poems in these two volumes are short and precise. The images are portrayed with the sensitive intensity of impressionistic technique. The majestic quietude of the long lines of the Book of Pictures is broken, the colors are more vibrant, more scintillating, and the pictures are painted in nervous, darting strokes as though to convey the manner in which they were perceived in one single, all-absorbing glance. For this reason, many of these new poems are not quite free from a certain element of virtuosity. On the other hand, Rilke achieves at times a perfect surety of rapid stroke, as in the poem, The Spanish Dancer, who rises luminously on the horizon of our inner vision like a circling element of fire, flaming and blinding in the momentum of her movements. Degas and Zuloaga seem to have combined their art on one canvas to give to this dancer the abundant elasticity of grace and the splendid fantasy of color. Many of the themes in the new poems bear testimony to the fact that Rilke traveled extensively prior to the writing of these volumes in Italy, Germany, France, and Scandinavia. His book on the five painters at the artist's colony at Werpswied, where he remained for a time, entirely given over to the observation of the atmosphere, the movement of the sky and the play of light upon the far heath of this northern landscape, is an introduction to every interpretation of the work of landscape painters and a tender poem to a land whose solitary and melancholy beauty entered into his own work, more vital than the influence of the personalities and the art treasures of the countries which Rilke visited and more potent in its effect upon. His creations, like a great sun over the most fruitful years of his life, stands the towering personality of August Rodin. The new poems bear the dedication, A Mon Grand Ami, August Rodin, indicating the twofold influence which the French sculptor wielded over the poet, that of a friend and that of an artist. One recalls the broad, solidly built figure of Rodin with his rugged features and high, finely chiseled forehead, moving slowly among the white glistening marble busts and statues as a giant in an old legend. Moves among the rocks and mountains of his realm, patient, all-enduring, the man who has mastered life, strong and tempered by the storms of time. And one thinks of Rainer Maria Rilke, young, blonde, with his slender aristocratic figure, the slightly bent forward figure of one who, on solitary walks, meditates much and intensely with his sensitive full mouth and the firm structure of the eyebrow gladly sunk in the shadow of contemplation, the face full of dreams and with an expression of listening to some distant music, from no other book of his, not excepting the Book of Hours. Can we deduce so accurate a conception of Rilke's philosophy of life and art as we can draw from his comparatively short monograph on August Rodin? Rilke sees in Rodin the dominant personification in our age of the power of servitude in all nature. For this reason, the book on Rodin is far more than a purely aesthetic valuation of the sculptor's work. Rilke traces throughout the book the strongly ethical principle which works itself out in every creative act in the realm of art. This grasp of the deeper significance of all art gives to the book on Rodin its well-nigh religious aspect of thought and its hymn-like rhythm of expression. He begins, Rodin was solitary before fame came to him, and afterward he became perhaps still more solitary, for fame is ultimately but the summary of all misunderstandings that crystallize about a new name. And he sums up this one man's greatness. Sometime it will be realized what has made this great artist so supreme. He was a worker whose only desire was to penetrate with all his forces into the humble and the difficult significance of his tool. Therein lay a certain renunciation of life, but in just this renunciation lay his triumph, for life entered into his work. Rodin became to Rilke the manifestation of the divine principle of the creative impulse in man. Thus Rilke's monograph on August Rodin will remain the poet's testament on life and art. Rilke has lived deeply. He has absorbed into his artistic and spiritual consciousness many of the supreme values of our time. His art holds the mystic depth of the Slav, the musical strength of the German, and the visual clarity of the Latin. As artist, he has felt life to be sacred, and as a priest, he has brought to its altar many offerings. H.T. New York City, Autumn 1918, 1st P.O.E.M.S. Evening, the bleak fields are asleep. My heart alone wakes, the evening in the harbor, down his red sails takes. Night, guardian of dreams. Now wanders through the land the moon, a lily white, blossoms within her hand, Mary Virgin. How came from out thy night, Mary, so much light and so much gloom? Who was thy bridegroom thou callest and thou hast forgot, that thou the same art not? Who came to me in thy virginity? I am still so blossoming, so young. How shall I go on tiptoe, from childhood to annunciation, through the dim twilight, into thy garden, the book of PICTURES, presaging? I am like a flag unfurled in space. I sent the oncoming winds and must bend with them, while the things beneath are not yet stirring, while doors close gently and there is silence in the chimneys, and the windows do not yet tremble and the dust is still heavy. Then I feel the storm and am vibrant like the sea, and expand and withdraw into myself, and thrust myself forth and am alone in the great storm. Autumn. The leaves fall as from far. Like distant gardens withered in the heavens, they fall with slow and lingering descent, and in the nights the heavy earth, too, falls from out the stars into the solitude. Thus all doth fall. This hand of mine must fall, and lo, the other one. It is the law, but there is one who holds this falling. Infinitely softly in his hands, silent hour. Whoever weeps somewhere out in the world, weeps without cause in the world, weeps over me. Whoever laughs somewhere out in the night, laughs without cause in the night, laughs at me. Whoever wanders somewhere in the world, wanders in vain in the world, wanders to me. Whoever dies somewhere in the world, dies without cause in the world, looks at me. The ANGLS. They all have tired mouths. And luminous, illimitable souls, and a longing, as if for sin trembles at times through their dreams, they all resemble one another. In God's garden they are silent, like many, many intervals in his mighty melody. But when they spread their wings, they awaken the winds, that stir as though God, with his far-reaching master hands, turned the pages of the dark book of beginning, solitude. Solitude is like a rain, that from the sea at dusk begins to rise, it floats remote across the far-off plain. Upward into its dwelling place, the skies, then o'er the town it slowly sinks again. Like rain, it softly falls at that dim hour, when ghostly lanes turn toward the shadowy morn, when bodies weighed with satiate passion's power, sad, disappointed from each other turn, when men with quiet hatred burning deep, together in a common bed must sleep. Through the gray, phantom shadows of the dawn, lo, solitude floats down the river wan, kings in old legends seem. Like mountains rising in the evening light, they blind all with their gleam, their loins encircled are by girdles bright. Their robes are edged with bands of precious stones, the rarest earth affords. With richly jeweled hands, they hold their slender, shining, naked swords, the night. The night rides forth in coat of mail into the roar of the world, and here is life. The vines in the vale, and friend and foe, and the feast in the hall, and May and the maid, and the glen and the grail, God's flags afloat on every wall. In a thousand streets unfurled, beneath the armor of the night, behind the chain's black links, death crouches and thinks, when will the sword's blade sharp and bright, forth from the scabbard spring, and cut the network of the cloak, and meshing me ring on ring, when will the foe's delivering stroke set me free to dance and sing? The boy, I wish I might become like one of these, who in the night on horses wild astride, with torches flaming out like loosened hair, on to the chase through the great swift wind ride. I wish to stand as on a boat and dare, the sweeping storm mighty, like flag unrolled, in darkness but with helmet made of gold, that shimmers restlessly. And in a row, behind me in the dark, 10 men that glow, with helmets that are restless too like mine, now old and dull, now clear as glass they shine. One stands by me and blows a blast apace, on his great flashing trumpet, and the sound shrieks through the vast black solitude around, through which, as through a wild mad dream, we race. The houses fall behind us on their knees, before us bend the streets and them we gain, the great squares yield to us and them we seize, and on our steeds rush like the roar of rain, initiation, whosoever thou art. Out in the evening roam, out from thy room thou knowest thee in every part, and far in the dim distance leave thy home, whosoever thou art. Lift thine eyes which lingering see, the shadows on the foot-worn threshold fall, lift thine eyes slowly to the great dark tree. That stands against heaven, solitary, tall, and thou hast visioned life, its meanings rise. Like words that in the silence clearer grow as they unfold before thy will to know, gently withdraw thine eyes. The NEIGHBOUR, Strange Violin. Dost thou follow me in many foreign cities far away? Thy lone voice spoke to me like memory. Do hundreds play thee, or does but one play are there in all great cities tempest-tossed? Men who would seek the rivers but for thee. Who but for thee would be forever lost? Why drifts thy lonely voice always to me? Why am I the neighbor always? Of those who force to sing thy trembling strings, life is more heavy, thy song says, than the vast, heavy burden of all things, song of the statue. Who so loveth me that he will give his precious life for me, I shall be set free from the stone. If someone drowns for me in the sea, I shall have life, life of my own. For life I ache. I long for the singing blood. The stone is so still and cold. I dream of life, life is good. Will no one love me and be bold and me awake? I weep and weep alone, weep always for my stone. What joy is my blood to me? If it ripens like red wine, it cannot call back from the sea the life that was given for mine, given for love's sake, maidens. I, others must by a long dark way stray to the mystic bards, or ask someone who has heard them sing, or touch the magic chords. Only the maidens question not. The bridges that lead to dream, their luminous smiles are like strands of pearls, on a silver vase agleam. The maidens' doors of life lead out, where the song of the poet soars, and out beyond to the great world. To the world beyond the doors, maidens. Aye, aye, maidens, the poets learn from you to tell how solitary and remote you are. As night is lighted by one high bright star, they draw light from the distance where you dwell. For poet you must always maiden be, even though his eyes the woman in you wake. Wedding brocade your fragile wrists would break. Mysterious, elusive, from him flee. Within his garden let him wait alone, where benches stand expectant in the shade. Within the chamber where the lyre was played, where he received you as the eternal one, go. It grows dark, your voice and form no more his senses seek. He now no longer sees a white robe fluttering under dark beech trees, along the pathway where it gleamed before. He loves the long paths where no footfalls ring. And he loves much the silent chamber where, like a soft whisper through the quiet air, he hears your voice, far distant, vanishing. The softly stealing echo comes again from crowds of men whom wearily he shuns, and many see you there, so his thought runs, and tenderest memories are pierced with pain. The bride, call me, beloved. Call aloud to me. Thy bride her vigil at the window keeps, the evening wanes to dusk, the dimness creeps down empty alleys of the old plane tree. Oh, let thy voice enfold me close about. Or from this dark house, lonely and remote, through deep blue gardens where gray shadows float, I will pour forth my soul with hands stretched out. Autumnal day, Lord, it is time. So great was summer's glow, thy shadows lay upon the dial's faces, and o'er wide spaces let thy tempests blow, command to ripen the last fruits of thine. Give to them two more burning days and press the last sweetness into the heavy wine. He who has now no house will ne'er build one. Who is alone will now remain alone. He will awake, will read, will letters write. Through the long day and in the lonely night, and restless, solitary, he will rove, where the leaves rustle, wind-blown in the grove, moonlight night, South German night. The ripe moon hangs above, weaving enchantment o'er the shadowy lea. From the old tower the hours fall heavily into the dark as though into the sea. A rustle, a call of night watch in the grove. Then for a while void silence fills the air, and then a violin from God knows where awakes and slowly sings, O love, in April. Again the woods are odorous, the lark lifts on upsoaring wings the heaven gray that hung above the treetops, veiled and dark, where branches bare disclose the empty day. After long rainy afternoons an hour comes with its shafts of golden light and flings them at the windows in a radiant shower, and rain drops beat the panes like timorous wings, then all is still. The stones are crooned to sleep by the soft sound of rain that slowly dies, and cradled in the branches, hidden deep. In each bright bud, a slumbering silence lies, memories of a childhood. The darkness hung like richness in the room, when like a dream the mother entered there, and then a glass's tinkle stirred the air. Near where a boy sat in the silent gloom, the room betrayed the mother, so she felt. She kissed her boy and questioned, "Are you here?" And with a gesture that he held most dear, down for a moment by his side she knelt. Toward the piano they both shyly glanced, for she would sing to him on many a night. And the child seated in the fading light would listen strangely as if half entranced, his large eyes fastened with a quiet glow upon the hand which by her ring seemed bent, and slowly wandering o'er the white keys went, moving as though against a drift of snow. Death, before us great death stands, our fate held close within his quiet hands, when with proud joy we lift life's red wine to drink deep of the mystic shining cup, and ecstasy through all our being leaps. Death bows his head and weeps. The ASHANTE. Ardent acclimatation, Paris, no vision of exotic southern countries, no dancing women, supple, brown, and tall, whirling from out their falling draperies, to melodies that beat a fierce mad call, no sound of songs that from the hot blood rise, no languorous, stretching, dusky velvet maids, flashing like gleaming weapon their bright eyes, no swift, wild thrill the quickening blood pervades. Only mouths widening with a still broad smile of comprehension, a strange knowing leer at white men, at their vanity and guile. An understanding that fills one with fear. The beasts in cages much more loyal are, restlessly pacing, pacing to and fro, dreaming of countries beckoning from afar, lands where they roamed in days of long ago. They burn with an unquenched and smothered fire, consumed by longings over which they brood, oblivious of time, without desire, alone and lost in their great solitude, remembrance, expectant and waiting you muse, on the great rare thing which alone, to enhance your life you would choose, the awakening of the stone. The deeps where yourself you would lose, in the dusk of the shelves, embossed, shine the volumes in gold and browns, and you think of countries once crossed, of pictures, of shimmering gowns of the women that you have lost, and it comes to you then at last. And you rise, for you are aware of a year in the far-off past, with its wonder and fear and prayer, music. What play you, oh boy? Through the garden it stole, like wandering steps, like a whisper, then mute. What play you, oh boy? Lo, your gypsying soul is caught and held fast in the pipes of Pan's flute, and what conjure you? Imprisoned is the song. It lingers and longs in the reeds where it lies. Your young life is strong, but how much more strong is the longing that through your music sighs? Let your flute be still and your soul float through waves of sound, formless as waves of the sea. For here your song lived and it wisely grew before it was forced into melody. Its wings beat gently, its note no more calls. Its flight has been spent by you, dreaming boy. Now it no longer steals over my walls, but in my garden I'd woo it to joy, maiden melancholy. A young knight comes into my mind, as from some myth of old he came. You felt yourself entwined, as a great storm would round you wind, he went. A blessing undefined seemed left, as when church bells declined and left you wrapped in prayer. You fain would cry aloud, but bind your scarf about you and tear blind, weep softly in its fold. A young knight comes into my mind, full armored forth to fare. His smile was luminously kind, like glint of ivory enshrined, like a home longing undivined, like Christmas snows where dark ways wind, like sea pearls about turquoise twined, like moonlight silver when combined with a loved book's rare gold, maiden's AT confirmation. Paris in May 1903, the white-veiled maids to confirmation go, through deep green garden paths they slowly wind, their childhood they are leaving now behind, the future will be different, they know, oh, will it come? They wait, it must come soon. The next long hour slowly strikes at last, the whole house stirs again, the feast is past, and sadly passes by the afternoon, like resurrection were the garments white. The wreathed procession walked through trees arched wide, into the church as cool as silk inside, with long aisles of tall candles flaming bright. The lights all shone like jewels rich and rare, to solemn eyes that watched them gleam and flare. Then through the silence the great song rose high, up to the vaulted dome like clouds it soared. Then luminously, gently down it poured. Over white veils like rain it seemed to die. The wind through the white garments softly stirred, and they grew vari-colored in each fold, and each fold hidden blossoms seemed to hold, and flowers and stars and fluting notes of bird, and dim, quaint figures shimmering like gold, seemed to come forth from distant myths of old. Outside the day was one of green and blue, with touches of a luminous glowing red. Across the quiet pond the small waves sped. Beyond the city, gardens hidden from view sent odors of sweet blossoms on the breeze, and singing sounded through the far-off trees. It was as though garlands crowned everything, and all things were touched softly by the sun, and many windows opened one by one, and the light trembled on them glistening. The woman who loves, ah yes, I long for you. To you I glide and lose myself, for to you I belong, the hope that hitherto I have denied. Imperious comes to me as from your side, serious, unfaltering, and swift and strong. Those times, the times when I was quite alone, by memories wrapped that whispered to me low, my silence was the quiet of a stone, over which rippling, murmuring waters flow. But in these weeks of the awakening spring, something within me has been freed, something that in the past dark years unconscious lay, which rises now within me and commands, and gives my poor warm life into your hands, who know not what I was that yesterday. Pont Ducarusel. Upon the bridge the blind man stands alone. Gray like a mist-veiled monument he towers, as though of nameless realms the boundary stone, about which circle distant starry hours. He seems the center around which stars glow, while all earth's ostentations surge below. Immovably and silently he stands, placed where the confused current ebbs and flows, past fathomless dark depths that he commands, A shallow generation drifting goes. Madness, she thinks. I am, have you not seen? Who are you then, Marie? I am a queen, to your knee. And then she weeps, I was a child. Who were you then, Marie? Know you that I was no man's child, poor and in rags, said she, and then a princess I became, to whom men bend their knees to princes things are not the same as those a beggar sees, and those things which have made you great, came to you, tell me, when one night quite late, things became different then, I walked the lane which presently, with strung chords seemed to bend, then Marie became melody, and danced from end to end. The people watched with startled mien, and passed with frightened glance, for all know that only a queen may dance in the lanes, dance. Lament, oh, all things are long passed away and far, a light is shining but the distant star, from which it still comes to me has been dead, a 1,000 years, in the dim phantom boat, that glided past some ghastly thing was said, a clock just struck within some house remote, which house? I long to still my beating heart, beneath the sky's vast dome I long to pray. Of all the stars there must be far away, a single star which still exists apart, and I believe that I should know the one, which has alone endured and which alone, like a white city that all space commands, at the ray's end in the high heaven stands, symbols. From infinite longings finite deeds rise, as fountains spring toward far-off glowing skies, but rushing swiftly upward weakly bend, and trembling from their lack of power descend. So through the falling torrent of our fears, our joyous force leaps like these dancing tears, new poems, early Apollo, as when at times there breaks through branches bare, a morning vibrant with the breath of spring, about this poethead a splendor rare, transforms it almost to a mortal thing, there is as yet no shadow in his glance. Too cool his temples for the laurel's glow, but later o'er those marble brows, perchance, a rose garden with bushes tall will grow, and single petals one by one will fall, or the still mouth and break its silent thrall. The mouth that trembles with a dawning smile, as though a song were rising there the while, the tomb of a young girl, we still remember, the same as of yore, all that has happened once again must be, as grows a lemon tree upon the shore. It was like that, your light, small breast you bore. And his blood's current course like the wild sea, that god, who was the wanderer, the slim, despoiler of fair women, he the wise, but sweet and glowing as your thoughts of him, who cast a shadow over your young limb, while bending like your arched brows o'er your eyes, the poet, you hour, from me you ever take your flight, your swift wings wound me as they were along, without you void would be my day and night, without you I'll not capture my great song, I have no earthly spot where I can live. I have no love, I have no household fane, and all the things to which myself I give, impoverish me with richness they attain, the panther, his weary glance from passing by the bars, has grown into a dazed and vacant stare, it seems to him there are 1,000 bars, and out beyond those bars the empty air, the pad of his strong feet, that ceaseless sound of supple tread behind the iron bands, is like a dance of strength circling around, while in the circle, stunned, a great will stands. But there are times the pupils of his eyes dilate, the strong limbs stand alert apart, tense with the flood of visions that arise, only to sink and die within his heart. Growing blind, among all the others there sat a guest, who sipped her tea as if one apart, and she held her cup not quite like the rest, once she smiled so it pierced one's heart, when the group of people arose at last, and laughed and talked in a merry tone, as lingeringly through the rooms they passed, I saw that she followed alone. Tense and still like one who to sing must rise, before a throng on a festal night, she lifted her head and her bright glad eyes were like pools which reflected light. She followed on slowly after the last, as though some object must be passed by, and yet as if were at once but passed, she would no longer walk but fly, the Spanish dancer. As a lit match first flickers in the hands, before it flames and darts out from all sides, bright, twitching tongues, so, ringed by growing bands. Spectators, she, quivering, glowing stands, poised tensely for the dance, then forward glides and suddenly becomes a flaming torch. Her bright hair flames, her burning glances scorch, and with a daring art at her command, her whole robe blazes like a firebrand, from which is stretched each naked arm, awake, gleaming and rattling like a frightened snake. And then, as though the fire fainter grows, she gathers up the flame, again it glows, as with proud gesture and imperious air. She flings it to the earth, and it lies there, furiously flickering and crackling still. Then haughtily victorious, but with sweet, swift smile of greeting, she puts forth her will, and stamps the flames out with her small firm feet, offering. My body glows in every vein and blooms, to fullest flower since I first knew thee. My walk unconscious pride and power assumes. Who art thou then, thou who awaitest me, when from the past I draw myself the while? I lose old traits as leaves of autumn fall, I only know the radiance of thy smile. like the soft gleam of stars, transforming all. Through childhood's years I wandered unaware, of shimmering visions my thoughts now arrests, to offer thee as on an altar fair, that's lighted by the bright flame of thy hair, and wreathed by the blossoms of thy breasts. Love song, when my soul touches yours a great chord sings, how shall I tune it then to other things, oh? That some spot in darkness could be found, that does not vibrate whene'er your depths sound, but everything that touches you and me. Welds us as played strings sound one melody. Where is the instrument whence the sounds flow, and who's the master hand that holds the bow, oh? Sweet song, archaic torso of Apollo, we cannot fathom his mysterious head, through the veiled eyes no flickering ray is sent, but from his torso gleaming light is shed, as from a candelabrum, inward bent, his glance there glows and lingers. Otherwise, the round breast would not blind you with its grace, nor could the soft curved circle of the thighs. Steel to the arc whence issues a new race, nor could this stark and stunted stone display vibrance beneath the shoulder's heavy bar, nor shine like fur upon a beast of prey, nor break forth from its lines like a great star. There is no spot that does not bind you fast and transport you back to a far past, the book of HOURS, the book of a monk's life. I live my life in circles that grow wide and endlessly unroll. I may not reach the last, but on I glide, strong pinion toward my goal. About the old tower, dark against the sky, the beat of my wings hums. I circle about God, sweep far and high, on through millenniums. Am I a bird that skims the clouds along, or am I a wild storm or a great song? Many have painted her. But there was one who drew his radiant colors from the sun, mysteriously glowing through a background dim. When he was suffering, she came to him, and all the heavy pain within his heart rose in his hands and stole into his art. His canvas is the beautiful bright veil through which her sorrow shines. There where the texture o'er her sad lips is closely drawn, a trembling smile softly begins to dawn, though angels with seven candles light the place. You cannot read the secret of her face. In cassocks clad, I have had many brothers. In southern cloisters where the laurel grows, they paint Madonnas like fair human mothers, and I dream of young Titians and of others, in which the god with shining radiance glows, but though my vigil constantly I keep. My god is dark like woven texture flowing, 100 drinking roots all intertwined, I only know that from his warmth I'm growing, more I know not. My roots lie hidden deep. My branches only are swayed by the wind, thou anxious one. And dost thou the knot here? Against thee all my surging senses sing, about thy face in circles drawing near. My thought floats like a fluttering white wing, dost thou not see, before thee stands my soul. In silence wrapped my springtime's prayer to pray. But when thy glance rests on me then my whole, being quickens and blooms like trees in May. When thou art dreaming then I am thy dream, but when thou art awake I am thy will, potent with splendor, radiant and sublime, expanding like far space starlit and still, into the distant mystic realm of time. I love my life's dark hours, in which my senses quicken and grow deep, while, as from faint incense of faded flowers or letters old, I magically steep myself in days gone by. Again I give myself unto the past. Again I live. Out of my dark hours wisdom dawns apace. Infinite life unrolls its boundless space. Then I am shaken as a sweeping storm shakes a ripe tree that grows above a grave, round whose cold clay the roots twine fast and warm, and youth's fair visions that glowed bright and brave, dreams that were closely cherished and for long, are lost once more in sadness and in song. The book of pilgrimage, by day thou art the legend and the dream, that like a whisper floats about all men, the deep and brooding stillnesses which seem, after the hour has struck, to close again, and when the day with drowsy gesture bends and sinks to sleep beneath the evening skies, as from each roof a tower of smoke ascends. So does thy realm, my God, around me rise, all those who seek thee tempt thee, and those who find would bind thee, to gesture and to form, but I would comprehend thee. As the wide earth unfolds thee, thou growest with my maturity, thou art in calm and storm. I ask of thee no vanity to evidence and prove thee, thou wert in aeons old, perform no miracles for me, but justify thy laws to me, which, as the years pass by me, all soundlessly unfold. In a house was one who arose from the feast, and went forth to wander in distant lands, because there was somewhere far off in the east, a spot which he sought where a great church stands. And ever his children, when breaking their bread, thought of him and rose up and blessed him as dead. In another house was the one who had died, who still sat at table and drank from the glass, and ever within the walls did abide. For out of the house he could no more pass, and his children set forth to seek for the spot. Where stands the great church which he forgot? Extinguish my eyes, I still can see you. Close my ears, I can hear your footsteps fall, and without feet I still can follow you. And without voice, I still can to you call. Break off my arms and I can embrace you, enfold you with my heart as with a hand. Hold my heart, my brain will take fire of you, as flax ignites from a lit firebrand, and flame will sweep in a swift rushing flood through all the singing currents of my blood. In the deep nights I dig for you, O treasure, to seek you over the wide world I roam, for all abundance is but meager measure of your bright beauty which is yet to come. Over the road to you the leaves are blowing. Few follow it, the way is long and steep. You dwell in solitude, O does your glowing heart in some far-off valley lie asleep, my bloody hands, with digging bruised, I've lifted. Spread like a tree, I stretch them in the air. To find you before day to night has drifted, I reach out into space to seek you there. Then, as though with a swift, impatient gesture, flashing from distant stars on sweeping wing, you come, and over earth a magic vesture steals gently as the rain falls in the spring, the book of poverty and death. Her mouth is like the mouth of a fine bust, that cannot utter sound, nor breathe, nor kiss, but that had once from life received all this, which shaped its subtle curves, and ever must, from fullness of past knowledge dwell alone, a thing apart, a parable in stone, alone thou wanderest through space, profound one with the hidden face, thou art poverty's great rose, the eternal metamorphose, of gold into the light of sun. Thou art the mystic homeless one, into the world thou never came. Too mighty thou, too great to name, voice of the storm, song that the wild wind sings, thou harp that shatters those who play thy strings, a watcher of thy spaces make me a listener at thy stone, give to me vision and then wake me, upon thy oceans all alone. Thy river's courses let me follow, where they leap the crags in their flight, and where at dusk in caverns hollow, they croon to music of the night, send me far into thy barren land, where the snow clouds the wild wind drives, where monasteries like gray shrouds stand, august symbols of unlived lives, their pilgrims climb slowly one by one, and behind them a blind man goes, with him I will walk till day is done, up the pathway that no one knows. End of the project. GUTMBRGEBOOKPOEMS*. Updated editions will replace the previous one, the old editions will be renamed, creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark, if you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start full license. The full Project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8, 1B. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. C. Paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg Electronic Works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg, 1E1, the following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to a work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted, with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the Project Gutenberg license. 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense, To the user, provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original, plain, vanilla ASCII, or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9. 1E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that /he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as but not limited to incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty, disclaimer of DAMAGES, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, and any other party distributing a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive, or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you received the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you received the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1. F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth. In paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of MERCHANTBLITY or fitness for any purpose. 1. F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1. F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone, providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur. A distribution of this, or any Project Gutenberg work, B, alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and C, any defect you cause, Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit, 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the State of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN, or federal tax identification, number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair, NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up to date contact information can be found at the foundation's website and official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the project. Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks. This is the end of the audiobook. Thank you for listening. You can listen to and download more audiobooks at threeords.com.